This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Think about it. Deep conversations with Uli Bear on big ideas and great books.
Well, thank you for joining me on the Think About It podcast.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
It's really fantastic, and I want to introduce you briefly. And today we're talking about Emma Goldman, Revolution is a Way of Life, a biography you've written in the Yale Jewish Life series for Yale University Press. And you yourself have written so many books that have been so influential and important for people.
No kidding.
The Romance of American Communism is one we can go back to. The Odd Woman in the City, which is your way of making sense of your experience. And I'll return to that, how to make sense of personal experience in a larger sense. Fierce Attachments, which is a memoir of your life and your mother and grandmother in the location where Emma Goldman actually operated and lived for a long time, the Lower East Side in New York City. The end of the, I have the book right here, the end of the novel of Love, and love is a big topic for Goldman as well.
Yes.
So you were invited, I assume, to consider writing this biography of Emma Goldman, who's mostly known today as a great anarchist speaker and orator, and not really a writer, as an incredibly well-known woman in the early 20th century in America and internationally. Mm-hmm. And you were invited to write about it because when I look you up and when people refer to you, you are a self-identified radical feminist.
Right.
So can you say something about this invitation to write about Goldman, who may or may not be quite considered a feminist in today's use of that word, but obviously appealed to you.
She's not a feminist.
So she appealed to you for some reason. Can you start us out by saying what appealed to you about writing this biography about Emma Goldman?
Well, indeed, as you've already said, she's a great and famous. I am the a child of the left. I was raised in a socialist communist home. And for my mother had a number of female radical heroes. And one was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, one was Dorothy Day, and one was Emma Rosa Luxemburg, and Emma. So my mother, you know, she passed this on to me. She said, she kept telling me they were great women whenever the occasion warranted such a thing. So I grew up and for me, radicalism, conventional radicalism, radicalism on the left, the radicalism of the international working class and Marxism and the Communist Party and all of that, that was a great romance for me, as I even titled a book about American communists as The Romance of American Communism, and it was a great romance. So Emma became, enshrined in that history. Radical feminism is another another story. Radical feminism has clearly to do not with overturning anything, but with inclusivity, right? Radical feminism is the work of dissenters, not revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. All right. So we are people, as all the liberationist movements are, we want in. We are the people who are accusing the American democracy of not having fulfilled its promise. You know, all men are equal. Oh, really? What about women? And all men are equal anyway? You know, what about 5 million people who are not able? So that's radical feminism. When I was approached, writing the story of Emma was not my idea. I was approached by Jewish Lives and asked to write this book. And at the time, I really hardly remembered her. I mean, I just remembered the general outline, but I had not continued to think about her in any way. So I, too, like everybody I knew, you mentioned Emma Goldman, and every feminist said, I mean, women were naming their dogs Emma in the 70s, not really knowing what Emma's actual position on feminism was, mm-hmm. which was definitely not, she was definitely not an ally at all. What she was a modernist in the sense that she applauded free love mm-hmm. and sex without marriage mm-hmm. and birth control. Mm-hmm. These were feminist issues,
yes.
which she did obviously support in the extreme, went to jail on behalf of birth control. But curiously enough, you know, as you've read her now, she deplored the modern woman because she thought love was the most important, like my mother, she thought love was the most important thing in a woman's life.
So she had three issues that
she was
would fit into the radical feminist moment in the 70s. So birth control,
yeah,
free love, meaning not coercion.
What the hell is free love mean in the 1970s?
And what did it mean to her? Feminist issues, properly speaking, right? Still,
yeah. Well, now,
what would they just have been like women's issues? I mean, what I thought she brought into the conversation.
Yeah, they are women's issues,
right? So we can talk about what
not free love. That was everybody's issue. Women suffered. I mean, mm-hmm. women suffered mm-hmm. from the consequences of free love. In the sense that if you were not married and had an affair and got pregnant, your life was ruined. And that was certainly not true for men. So free love carried many more penalties for women
right.
than, and a woman was ruined anyway if she was known to take lovers. You had to be really bold and really independent and belong to Greenwich Village. You needed to belong to the Bohemia that supported all of those credos.
So when you went back to Emma Goldman after you got this, accepted this assignment,
yeah.
so in your mind, there's kind of the memory of your mother. This is one of the lodestars of her universe.
Yes.
It's a romance.
Yeah.
But then you go deeper and say, what really are her political positions?
Right.
But
and
the book
complicated,
but the book is not really, you didn't set out to say, I'm going to write a explanation of her political theories. You wanted to capture her life.
Right.
And that's a lot of your interest in your own writing as well, to take a life and say, what does it say that is more universal or general rather than the specificity of this life?
I'll tell you the actual history of writing this book in this sense that you're discussing now. When I agreed to write this and then I found myself at a loss, I didn't know. After all, these books are short books. These are introductions. These are meant to be introductory essays.
This is the book right here, actually, yes.
A book like this?
Right.
Yeah, there it is. And I forget, how long is it? Just a little over 100 pages or something, right? 100, you mean how long? I don't know.
It's like 140.
It's about 142 pages. Okay, so then here you are with this, and then you read her writings, and you see, and you read stuff about her, and you read other people's biographies, and you see how complicated she is. And then you say to yourself, how the fuck am I going to organize this?
Mm-hmm.
And then you know that you have to look for a point of view that will supply you with a position, an organizing principle, a place in which to stand, around which to collect the material of her life, not the other way around in an ordinary biography where they're going, chronologically or anything remotely like that. So that was hard. It took me a long time. I really couldn't figure out where I stood in relation to her.
Yeah.
Or what to do with her. And then I hit on it. I said to myself, she's a born refusenik.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
This is how she was born. She was born to say, don't tell me I don't run things around here.
And she was born, fill us in for just briefly a moment, what's her childhood? She was born...
Worst. She was born into a Jewish... in one of these complete, like a shtetl life. She was born into a family of Jews, working class Jews, religious, not religious, but definitely, they themselves were not religious, but tainted by the shtetl life, which mm-hmm. was, of course, full of superstition, religious obeisance, lip service paid to, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Parents were miserable. This was all in the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
She was born in what is now Lithuania.
Yeah.
I can't remember now, right now.
Kovno.
Yeah, she was born in the Russian Empire. The father was a terrible loser. The mother hated him. he, in turn, became a brute. He was an impassioned, brutish man who took out on his children all his disappointments in life,
mm-hmm.
especially Emma. Emma turned out to be just as stubborn as he. She had the same character as this temperamental, tempestuous, impassioned man who always wanted his way and she always wanted her way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can chart that from the very beginning. I mean, I think I write. He did terrible things like making her walk across the room, I think, with a glass of water. And if she spilled a drop, she got hit.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that he never forgave her for, and this was the source of her strength as well as her extremity, she never cried. She never begged for, please stop, or please leave me. Never. Mm. Never. And that was the source both of her strength and her limitation.
Mm-hmm.
She could be stubborn till the end of life.
Can you stay with that for a moment? Because you said the organizing principle you found is that she's a refusenik, a born refusenik, someone
right.
who doesn't accept. What does she not accept? There she doesn't accept the authority
she
of her father.
She doesn't accept... imposed authority.
Yeah.
She doesn't accept any authority over herself that doesn't make sense to her.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel fair.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel just.
Yeah.
And from there to radical politics, she had the choice of becoming a socialist or an anarchist, but the anarchists were much more vivid for her,
yeah.
and they spoke much more clearly to who she really was. From there to that was one easy step, especially in her time.
From refusing kind of willful authority without any basis.
Yeah.
And this moment when you talked about when her father is punishing her and he wants her to just get married, be married off, get rid
right.
of her also because
right.
she's becoming a problem.
All that a girl has to know is how to make matzo ball soup or something like that.
Have babies, cut noodles, something like that.
And, that's right, cut
yes.
noodles fine.
Yeah, yeah, and make a filter fish. Right, that's the idea. She does not want to do this. She goes to America. But before that, when you said she doesn't ever complain, she doesn't cry,
no.
she doesn't become, and this is a bit shorthand, a victim in this. She actually,
that's
something
right.
else is released
herself.
In her.
Yeah, yeah.
Some strength rather than
right.
a feeling of, I can't defend myself.
Yeah, that's what politics did for people who had no power. Left-wing politics, especially, completely. It gave people a sense of power that, and I grew up among people like that. People who, as I wrote in The Romance of American Communism, I grew up among working class people who were nothing in the world. I mean, my father hung from a strap on a subway for 25 years, pressing dresses in a factory in Midtown Manhattan. So, but in the house, in our house, he was a significant figure. And that was partly because of this politics. because they had politics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To have politics was already to elevate yourself. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I grew up with so many people and known them all my life, especially then going to City College, living in New York all my life. People who came from the same background as me, but their parents had no politics at all. They were just appetite and acquisition.
And what was the difference between those people and your family that was politically minded?
Those people don't respect their parents. They were not influenced to the good mm-hmm. by their parents. Mm-hmm. They never saw anything elevating in life. It was all at the lowest, sort of the lowest levels, you know. It was all at the level of make enough money to buy a house and have a car.
Okay.
What I hear people talking about today with their kids.
Yeah.
In my time, it was all primitive. I mean, I was growing up in the 40s and 50s. If you've ever read Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates, mm-hmm. one of the great books of the 1960s, it was about the 50s. Revolutionary Road is about the 50s. And what he caught was the pain of that ordinariness of a decade in which people were solidly involved with security, with gaining security, with having, you know, it was like the Eisenhower era of radical politics at a really low level. The Rosenbergs executed, I don't have to go through all that. And at the same time, they were known as the silent generation. We were known as the silent generation. We weren't silent. People like me weren't silent. Nobody at City College was silent. But the general culture was to gain security. The man in the gray flannel suit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, work for a big corporation, gain security, be careful, be safe, be this, be that. I hear that now. All I hear from people my age or who are grandparents and their children who are in their 60s, I mean my 80s, and they are in their 60s and they have children or younger. They have children who are graduate students. They worry. At Thanksgiving, at the dinner table, I heard a woman whom I have great affection for. She's in her 50s. She got married late. She has kids who are graduate students. She was talking at the dinner table about how she worries that her kid will not be able to make enough money to have a house and a car. And I thought, and you hear that a lot if you're listening.
And you
I don't
thought
listen
that you've heard this in the 50s.
I thought, my God, I haven't heard this since
50 years.
Since Revolutionary Road. We did not grow up seeking security. But
you're still in a generation that had, I think, Goldman is in 1900. Right. Your parents are moving out of the Lower East Side to the Bronx some point.
Right.
So this is kind of moving up. And
upper class.
Your parents didn't leave their politics totally behind.
No.
So that's actually interesting to say. It's not just you move into... And the Bronx at this point is more like the suburbs, but they didn't leave their politics.
Yes, it was like it, but it wasn't the suburbs.
Right.
They were hanging from a strap 2 hours a day on the subway.
Yeah, yeah.
And the women were all shopping, coming home with big bags of food in their arms and living in cooperative circumstances, as I described in Fierce Attachments.
Mm-hmm.
All these women in all of these... Bronx and Brooklyn apartment houses with no power, no vision, no capacity for, they were living much more like their parents had lived, like my grandparents had lived, than I lived, like my mother lived.
Yeah.
The break between me and her is huge. The break between herself and her mother was not huge.
From more communal to less communal. From your mother still having a community of people.
Community is not a word they ever used.
So what would have been?
But yeah, that's right. What would it have been? What held everybody? It was like a tree grows in Brooklyn. What held people together was their working class status.
Like a shared set of experiences.
Yeah, they opened their doors. Everyone who had an apartment in a tenement house had an open door. And women could talk to each other immediately mm-hmm. because their lives were duplicates. Mm-hmm. They were. Mm-hmm. I mean, so every woman had the husband and the paycheck mm-hmm. and the worry about the rent and the food. Mm-hmm. These were real working class lives. Like, I mean, would you call a tenement building in the Bronx full of Spanish-speaking immigrants today, would you call that community? No.
It's like a shared set of experiences.
A shared experience.
The landlord or the city or the employment. Yeah.
But if my mother said to half the people in the tenement, you know, there's we have the right to fight this. We have the right to fight the landlord. We have the right to...
Right.
Most of them would look at her like she was crazy because they were terrified. I mean, most people are frightened of the first instinct is not
to fight,
go for help, you know, help for living.
And if we go back to the generation before, so this is Goldman almost coincides with your grandparents, not quite, but almost. So she comes to America, goes to Rochester, works in a sweatshop, and you do a very, to me, very surprising job. Actually, I have to confess. The way you describe what she enters is sweatshops, which is not just difficult working conditions. You work 10 hours, but it's hell.
Yeah.
It's enslavement. It's not just degrading. It is physically dangerous. It has zero.
Oh, I should go back and read
it. It's quite powerful, actually. You say she enters into something. She goes to Promised Land. She goes to America. She gets there with her sister. And then she enters into what she realizes. I left my father. I left the shtetl. And here I'm in Rochester. This is
worse.
Which is not something people want to say when they come to America.
No.
It's not supposed to be worse. It's supposed to be something else. So what happens to her? She finds herself in this context, and she's not formally educated at all. She doesn't know political thinking at all. So what happens to her as a 16-year-old girl, which is kind of, I'm thinking it's a six, she comes at about 16. So she's a teenager thrown into this hellish situation of making clothes or whatever she makes in the factory.
And somehow she finds her way to a socialist meeting. Now, the reason she finds her way is because of who she is, meeting up with a time that's receptive to who she is. You will remember, her sister doesn't do this at all.
Yeah.
Her sister goes to sleep after that. She works in the factory all day long. Emma goes off to a political meeting when she's 16.
Yeah, yeah.
This is temperament meeting the right time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just like us with feminism. In the 1980s, right, which is when I was converted, earlier, 1970s, 70s and 80s, in the 1970s, I forget the dates already, why did people like me suddenly hear people like Kate Millett talking? Or Gloria Steinem. I don't think Steinem was so hot yet, but I mean, the originals that I remember are Kate Millett, Susan Brown Miller, Alex Shulman. These women were already converted and talking. And I was sent by the Village Voice out to interview these liberationist chicks.
Yeah. Right.
As Ed Fancher said to me.
I'm trying to think, is Kate Millett the female eunuch? Or what's the book?
No, Kate Millett is Sexual Politics.
Sexual Politics. Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, yeah.
The female eunuch is Greer. What's her name?
Germaine Greer. Okay.
Who was English.
Yes,
Australian.
British. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But here, it was Kate Millett. Kate Millett was on the cover of Time.
Sexual Politics. I mean, okay. So you're a young reporter for The Voice and saying, interview these women.
Precisely. They say to me, go out and interview these chicks. Right. And I come back converted. Just converted. I heard what they said. And as I've written in a number of places, they were all saying it wasn't hard to find a whole bunch of them, one after another. T. Grace Atkinson, Betty Friedan.
Right.
Everybody was out there doing it. And I listened to all of them and I came back. And the thing that I heard, even though they were all saying different things, the thing that I heard from everyone was, men are born taking their brains seriously. Women are not. It was
men
natural.
Are born taking their brains seriously,
and women are absolutely not. Women are taught to not take their brains as if they were not equipped to take their brains seriously.
And you're a reporter.
Yeah,
you have.
This went through me like a dose of salt.
Really?
Yeah. I was in my early 30s.
Yeah,
and I was twice married. On the verge of divorce, second time, And I didn't know who the hell I was or where or what, or I didn't know what had happened to me from 23 to 33. And I was nowhere. I didn't know that I didn't feel natural inside myself until I heard.
As a thinking person?
Yes, a thinking person.
That, because you, at that moment you realized that had not, that wasn't really the identity you felt.
Right. I remember thinking all my young life that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know what that meant, and I didn't know how to start, what to do with it. As a little girl in grade school and in high school, the teacher would always hold up something I wrote and say, "This little girl is going to be a writer." Very nice. That was thrilling.
Right.
Then what?
And I think you write in one book, maybe it's in, I can't remember, maybe it's in The Odd Woman in the City, that you said you knew you wanted to be a writer, and then you thought, and then I'll probably meet a man and get married and be a writer. That was still part of the equation.
Exactly.
That was the other great story that you were taught.
Yeah. Right? I knew that I, as many women like me would have said, I knew that I wanted to do something great in life.
Okay.
But that I needed to find the right partner.
So you tried twice in your 20s. Okay.
Yeah.
So the second one, you're sort of getting through your divorce. And then, so when you see yourself for the first time in this way, how did that feel? This kind of, that you go interview these women.
Tremendously exciting. How did I see?
Yeah, like to actually recognize.
You know, there's nothing like insight, right? There's nothing in the world is as exciting, no matter how terrible a message is. It's so great to see things as they are, as you think they are.
Yeah. And you were ready, you said earlier, you were ready, like Emma Goldman, she met her moment, and you met that moment.
Exactly.
It's the 70s, you're a young
woman.
So there's a, it just happened to be the right moment, and you happened to be receptive to that.
But I've always felt if it had been the 1930s,
mm-hmm.
I would have been the reddest, hottest communist on the block.
Red Vivian. Okay, good.
The worst. I would have brought people up on charges.
Well, that's actually interesting. Then the zeitgeist, what was in the culture, was what Emma Goldman picked up is anarchism, socialism. This is what actually totally electrifies
with modernism.
Modernism
at the turn of the 20th century, in the years around the First World War, into the 20s, modernism was determined on a revolution in consciousness, which of course has held sway for 100 years already. They were not into socialism, and they were not into making America red. They were into making America self-knowing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This dovetailed with Emma and free love and mm-hmm. All that part of her set of convictions and allegiances. That part, you know, that way dovetailed with birth control, sex without marriage, and free love.
This emphasis on individuality. I want to be careful how to phrase that.
No, experiencing oneself and to have a life in which one was devoted to the full experience of the self.
And for a woman, I think that part included birth control for women more than men, because men were largely unburdened by that. Free love, meaning not have to be locked into marriage and not to be shamed.
And it also included women's rights, by the way. Yeah. Many of them were feminists, but the feminism was subordinate to, mm-hmm. it wasn't the main thing,
mm-hmm.
but it was definitely subordinate to all these questions that were being raised. But it was there, and there was lots of men in the village in those years called themselves feminists. Max Eastman called himself a feminist. Floyd Dell called himself a feminist. Lots of people who were well known in that piece of history, and they called themselves feminists, but they were sexist at the same time that they called themselves feminists. They went out to make the revolution, and the wife was sitting home doing all the rest of it. And when the wife turned out to be an artist herself, or a serious thinking person herself, the marriages fell apart.
Hmm. So they didn't really want a thinking woman at home.
I mean, no.
They wanted a thinking woman, maybe.
Yeah, they thought they did.
In the revolutionary future.
And they would marry a woman who was vigorously independent and smart and talented. And then the minute they got married, they wanted her.
Emma Goldman has one experience. You describe one of these experiences. She starts to become She starts to speak herself at these meetings. She draws on her own experience. We can talk about that. And then she has her own experience where one of her mentors who falls in love with her.
Johann Most.
And she returns from a trip to Chicago, I believe. She's really excited because she's actually connected to the crowd and she's starting to find her way of speaking to the crowd. And he basically doesn't really want to hear about it.
Yeah, basically he wants to sleep with her.
He's like, let's go home and have sex, and that's
he
it.
He brings her violets, his winter.
He brings her violets, and then there's someone else's outrage. Who is it? Sasha Berkman.
He's
outraged
already,
that he brings violets because it's, the workers are starving and you're
that's
extravagant.
Right. Sasha, do you know how much violets
like an Edith Wharton moment or something like that. But she has her own experience of that. The men in her life, and she has a lot of men in her life, which is quite important for her, right? You say for her story, it's important.
Yeah.
So it's not a feminist, a separatist who says free love and women are going to be detached from
not at all.
Heterosexual love at all, right? There's
none of that. She's full of contradictions. She doesn't think any of it out. She really doesn't. She was against fighting for suffrage. It was unbelievable. She was really against it, actively against it.
And say why she was against it? She has arguments.
It deracinates the modern woman. The modern woman doesn't know how to love if she keeps on hawking about the vote.
It's a contradiction. She says something here. I think I have this. But she said, emancipation has brought women economic equality with men, that she can choose her own profession and trade, but as her past and present has not equipped with all her energy, vitality, and strain every nerve. She loses herself. She said, women who start, they get political rights, economic rights, and look where they end up. Even unhappier. They're secretaries or even doctors or lawyers, lose everything about themselves. Return home in the evening and have to still run the household, but they're also not in touch with what she calls a vitality force.
Right.
And that always goes back to love, maternity. She doesn't have children herself.
No, that's the thing.
But something like an embodied experience.
Yeah.
Like, I would be curious what you make of this, because what you started out earlier, you found this kind of structuring principle for the biography, this refusenik. And in your other writing, you've talked a lot about turning experience isn't this self-evident thing. It's something that needs to be presented and interpreted.
Yeah.
And this moment when she's in the contradiction, and she says women shouldn't even get the right to vote, because what is that going to do for them?
Right, exactly. Her identity is very complicated. It's not simple. It's not simple. It's not usable as a feminist at all. It's just not. And it wasn't even then. She was constantly arguing, and she fell out with Margaret Sanger. They were both impossible. Each one was a Stalinist. They each have that Stalinist personality. You know, they're not flexible. They don't give. They're not interested in doing politics successfully as much as they are in declaring. Mm-hmm. Standing for that. And in fact, she was not a thinker. She was not a tactician.
Mm-hmm.
She was inspirational. Mm-hmm. What she was a woman of extraordinary character. I mean, like one of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing that she contributed was that she made people feel their condition better than anybody under the sun. She must have been thrilling to listen to.
And she spoke to huge crowds
and for years and years and years on end. And she could make them feel their subjected lives brilliantly. And that was her contribution. Unlike Rosa Luxemburg, who was inspirational and also an intellectual.
And I want to stay with this for a moment, that she's an inspiration or this incandescent event.
Yeah.
She's an appearance to people, but she doesn't give them the program what to do next. But let's just stay with it. But that is an important role. And there's also and one thing to connect to, which you point out in the book, there's an American tradition of these great orators or speakers or these inspirational figures. They can also be con men and seduce the masses, of course, in America. There's always two sides to this, at least. But there seems to be a particular thing she falls into in America. And there's a huge business of bringing people into the hall, lecture halls and stadiums and theaters to speak to people. And that to me seems very much connected to America as kind of, it's not a country where you start out with a full program.
No.
It's experimental, it's pragmatic.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's what she loved about America, and it's why of all the countries in the world that she could have lived in, some of which she did live in, she never stopped loving America. What she loved was the passion for individuation and the incredible capacity for protest, for, you know, standing up for your rights. And on the part of people who had no rights and were going to live and die in the shabbiest, most miserable of conditions. But, you know, Alexander Berkman, Sasha, who shot Frick 5 times and couldn't kill him.
So he shoots Frick, who's beating down a strike
right.
As the manager of a plant. And then Sasha.
Yeah, one of the most famous strikes in American history.
He walks in, shoots him how many
times? 5
times. 5 times and manages not to kill him.
Yeah.
But he goes to prison for a long time.
But he went to prison. He was sentenced to 22 years.
This is
years.
The Frick of the Frick Gal collection
yes,
uptown,
yes,
so we can
collection.
Now admire that name, which has been sanctified in American history.
Right. A robber baron. They all were. All those great collections come from robber barons. So so Sasha goes to prison, one of the worst, imagine, 1892. And he writes finally, he comes out after 14 years, but in the course of it, he writes her many, many letters, of course. And in them, he says, there'll never be a revolution in America. He suddenly sees the difference between a country where no matter how terrible the life is and no matter how these people are ending up in jail and they're black often on top of being on a chain gang, the worst life imaginable. And still they have deep within them the conviction that it's possible to become something different. That sense of expectation, which my mother embodied, that sense of expectation separated America, mm-hmm. the immigrants of America, mm-hmm. from every other country in the world. Because in all the other countries, you were a subject, and here you were potentially a citizen. And he, in prison, with the lowest of the low, and people whose lives are at an animal level and will never be any different, he could not persuade them to become socialists.
So they have something that he says is strangely empowering, but politically inaccessible.
It's an Americanism that will never be interested in socialist revolution, will never respond to it.
Because socialist actually would subjugate that kind of individualism.
They're convinced that socialism means the loss of individuality.
Yeah, yeah. Which may or may not be correct.
Yeah.
Right. We haven't probably found the right experiment, right? And Goldman taps into that, what you said earlier, she makes people feel their own experience, which is an interesting expression, as if people don't know their experience. But then they all know.
True enough, isn't it?
They come in the evening, they hear Emma Goldman. She gets
we both live sufficiently long to know that is true, right?
Well, I'm kind of interested in this concept of experience because it comes up throughout your writing to sort of, and you said in another text.
I've been accused of that.
No, it's in the end of the novel of love, you make this argument that in the 50s, people lived largely without experience because they actually sort of got swept into the molds of their parents. There's a pattern and you live that.
Absolutely.
And then you said, but you in the 60s and 70s, experience becomes this incredibly powerful thing that it's a new shape of life or something.
Right. It's to examine your actual feelings, not received feelings. Which is what psychoanalysis concentrates on. I mean, the Freudian century is devoted, supposedly, to people discovering exactly that. Well, what is it I really feel? What is it I really know? Where do I really feel at home inside myself? Where do I feel exiled inside myself?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These are vital questions which modernism was...
And Goldman is totally in it... But she doesn't think about them intellectually. She meets Freud, actually. I think she hears Freud speak or something in Europe at some point, which is kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
So
she gets some of it. She gets some of what I'm saying now, but nowhere near enough, which is what the whole world has been about. I mean, it's 100 years of trying to get more of Freud than Freud had, or these are concepts that are lived out again and again and again until they take, mm-hmm. both in society, mm-hmm. and in culture and in history. Mm-hmm. I mean, right? To say these things as I say them and have said them over and over and over again, and then to live as long as I've lived and to see myself struggling with the same things to this moment,
yeah.
is to have great respect for the strength of damage, for the strength of all the things that hold us back.
But that's interesting, what you just said. I was waiting what you were going to say. You didn't say you have great respect for the unwillingness to think or the ignorance of people. You said for the strength of damage. And Goldman, at every turn, when she talks about political assassination, about prostitution, about women's rights, she said, you can't blame these people for reacting. You have to look at a bigger place. You have to look at the system that made them do that. And what you just said, people are unwilling to reflect on their experience. They're not unwilling. They've been damaged. And that's a very
not
different...
Not they, we.
We, yes, we, thank you.
But you and I are not...
We're exempt
from this. Yeah.
But that's a very Goldman move, and I thought that was really interesting. She doesn't blame these people in front of her
and speak. Every now and then she does something like that, and then she's wise. Yeah. But she doesn't stick with it herself. She doesn't really deeply understand the implications of her own rhetoric. So that, what happens is... She has an orgasm, and she thinks it's transcendental. You know, she's flown to the moon, and she says, "Oh my God, this is real life.
Right.
Anything without this is not real life."
Right.
She goes no further. She can't. You know. Then those of us who lived long enough to incorporate the orgasm into ordinary everyday life. Think, that's not enough. I mean, that's not making me more of a human being than I was before.
So you would think, okay, so sexual infatuation or whatever, or like an incredible affair,
it's the repression.
One dimension.
What it is the orgasm is so powerful an experience because the culture has denied it.
Okay.
I mean, at that moment, the insight is so overpowering.
Because you didn't know this was even there, but that society has made you.
And when you do know it's there, especially when you're her and living in that time, when you do know it's there and you realize that the whole society is telling you this is wrong, this is wrong, it's wrong to do this, to have this, to feel this, and you think, that is not true. That's a revolutionary thought.
Oh, but that's interesting. So the truth of her experience depends on
the experience.
That society denies that all the time. Yeah. That's the other part of it. So she doesn't.
Yeah. And what I said in the end of the novel of love, which literature catches up with, catches up with to the degree that it can't undo the wisdom of knowing that a great sexual passion does not provide salvation.
Right.
Now, nobody could really... I mean, Anna Karenina had to throw herself in front of a train in order to make that clear. If you read the end of Anna Karenina again, as I did a few years ago, you're shocked by how brilliant as she's walking towards the train, whole last section.
Mm-hmm.
It's surreal.
Mm-hmm.
Her thoughts are surreal.
Surreal in what sense?
In that she's suddenly understanding that she put all her eggs in this basket. She gave up everything, and to give up everything then was to become a victim of the pandemic.
Shut yourself off.
Yeah, she's on lockdown forever.
Well, you say this about Mrs. Dalloway also in Wolf, which is interesting.
Yeah.
You say she actually locks herself into a kind of white, sexless marriage with Mr. Dalloway rather than living out this other life. But
yeah.
And you said that used to be a very real concern. Maybe it isn't quite the same for us anymore.
Well, we used to think that she was at fault. And we used to think that what Wolf was getting at was the limitations in Clarissa Dalloway's character or that of the whole society.
Yeah.
I mean, every woman like her, upper middle class women, who were cold and distant and using, had an instrumental relationship to marriage. And so I remember at City College when I was a kid, I was 20 years old reading Mrs. Dalloway and thinking, oh God, she's so cold. She's so without sensuality. That's what Wolf's seeing everywhere in her class, in her world. Then later as a feminist, I read and I think, well, of course, it's the only way she could save her life.
So you
take herself off to a virginal third floor bedroom.
And look at the lady across the street.
Yeah.
Goldman doesn't quite make that leap consistently to realize. She does sometimes. She realizes, okay, it's the circumstances that actually explain Mrs. Dalloway's withdrawal into this.
Yeah.
And Goldman does it sometimes, but you also said sometimes she doesn't even understand her own experience is also motivated or structured by that.
Right.
By society.
Well, that's true too. Yeah. Yes. She can't get that far. Well, she couldn't get that far because there wasn't enough cultural experience around her to reify what she experienced for herself and declared for other women was impossible for other women to achieve. And who could become Emma Goldman? I mean, you had to become Emma Goldman to live in 1910. The way she was right. encouraging everyone to live. I mean, 1910, you had a baby out of wedlock, you went to prison. I mean, she never really understood the ramifications of many of the positions, but it was important that she took those positions because it was invigorating. It made people have thoughts they never had before.
Yeah.
They couldn't act on it,
but
they could have them. Yeah. And therefore, that string of thoughts accumulates. When I said as a kid, none of these women around me had any experience. None. They married young.
Right.
Their husbands were the only men they ever slept with. They knew nothing. And they couldn't know anything. And it's only when a mass of people, when the culture really changes and a mass of people have the same experience, in other words, what I'm saying is when we did divorce men we weren't happy living with, or we did have many lovers and discovered the limitations of that goodness, that it was great and it was necessary, but it wasn't the whole world. And it didn't make us into different people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then later, everyone was in psychoanalysis and that has its limitations too, but it's 10 steps ahead of the orgasm.
Of valorizing the orgasm, transcendent moment or something like that.
To
go back to her sort of this, there's one part, she's exiled from America, she's deported with some 200 other, some people, ends in Finland,
right.
And then gets to the then newfound Soviet Union, which
right.
is brand new, the Russian Revolution has just happened and fascinated the world. She arrives in the newly formed, I guess it is the Soviet Union at that point, in 18 or so, 19, what is her experience there? And you sort of explain that based on your other knowledge of this whole history.
Well, yes. Very quickly, it's 1919. She was only there for 2 years. In 1921, they were gone. They were on their way out. Well, she sees, because she's an anarchist, not a communist. If you were a communist, you had blinders on. Your sight was sealed. You were passionately devoted to the revolution, and you couldn't take apart that. So you justified everything. And the horrors of gathering Bolshevism were apparent very quickly. But more important than anything else, anarchists were the enemy for the Bolsheviks. So even though Emma was a famous Bolshevik, a famous anarchist, and received special treatment by Lenin, by order of Lenin, very quickly, it was not enough. for her to not see the authoritarianism that was growing and growing and growing. And anarchists went to jail in the early Soviet Union.
And is she seeing, and I'm very, kind of, this is a very amateurish picture, but is she seeing that kind of in the Soviet Union, power is consolidated in the party? Yeah. The Soviets, which are supposed to be these elected councils by workers, are actually crushed, brutally beaten down the way the Frick of the America beat down the worker strikes. And Emma Goldman says this should not be consolidated into power by an elite.
Yeah, she said, this is another dictatorship.
Yeah,
I mean, the Communist Party is replacing the Tsar. The Soviets are more and more becoming puppet states. People are going to jail or open their mouths against what the Soviet Union became. It was becoming very quickly. And, you know, if she was told to shut her mouth in any situation,
she leaves the Soviet Union, then she's stateless.
Not a minute too soon.
Because she would have been arrested most likely.
And
ended up in Siberia or in the Gulag.
Yeah, would have been the end of her.
And then she writes a book a bit later, pretty quickly. Do we know anything about her writing practice? She's on a tour. She gives 120 lectures a year, and I don't know.
She stays up all night and writes.
She stays up all night.
She needs no sleep.
When she's not sleeping with one of her many lovers, she's actually writing.
Well, that's different. Then she's not sleeping. She's active. Very active.
She's doing a lot. So she writes this book about the Soviet Union.
Right. And of course, every sympathizer and every Red hates it immediately. I mean, she immediately becomes the enemy of the organized left.
So she's starting to lose a bit of her community there?
Oh, everyone. She loses a lot. She becomes deported in a million ways. In other words, her constituency shrinks practically to nothing. And that was true for all of them. There was a whole bunch of them, anarchists, from America, deported from America and other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I write about that. And I think I say in it, I think I even, no, oh, there's nothing. There's a photograph. There's a photograph of Emma and Sasha and a whole bunch of other people like them. They're on a terrace of a villa in Saint-Tropez, which subsequently became, you know, the rich, elegant playground of, you know, the wealthy and the beautiful, the rich and the beautiful. But in that time, it's like the early 1920s, and that villa was bought for her by Peggy Guggenheim. a Peggy Guggenheim could afford, then as now, to have any kind of friend she wanted to have.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, knowing Emma Goldman did not threaten Peggy Guggenheim,
mm-hmm.
nor did it make her an anarchist. I mean, she...
When Emma Goldman is writing against property and ownership and all this, but the Guggenheims at this point...
Says, want a house?
So she gets a little house in France. Then she needs also a refuge because she's stateless, she's thrown out everywhere.
Yeah.
She's starting to lose her footing, it seems.
She doesn't know it yet, but it's not coming back.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the end. Anyway, all these people, they all look like my grandmother. they all look like these dowdy-looking Jews from New York, and they're sitting on this terrace in Saint-Tropez, and they look miserable. All they want is to be on the Lower East Side.
To be back home, really.
And you can see, there must be down below them, the ocean, fantastic plants and flowers and gorgeousness. And all you can see in their faces, what am I doing here?
So they're in exile in a certain way.
Oh, totally. Yeah. They're in exile.
Yeah,
and they stayed in exile for the rest of their lives.
Hmm.
They know, after the First World War and after Bolshevism, after the Soviet Union became the Soviet Union, life is never the same for any of them.
What do you make of this book about the Soviet Union that basically paints a very negative picture of the Soviet Union?
Yeah.
And shapes perhaps the understanding of that experiment for a lot of Americans.
No, her book is not valuable precisely because it is so accusatory.
Mm.
It is so without sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just her being dogmatic this way instead of that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there was really nobody to speak to at that time. The only people who might have been happy to see such an anti-red book were the right wing in America and all the countries of the world. That's not what you wanted.
I want to ask you something, because we did a podcast with Anne Fernald and Raj Sekumar on Virginia Woolf's Three Guineas, 1938, which is a book where she says, Virginia Woolf, I'm not going to support your anti-war effort because we have a lot of things at home, namely the patriarchy, to take care of. It basically destroys a lot of our friendships. And then I had a conversation, I told you, with the late and amazing Richard Bernstein, exactly in this spot, about Hannah Arendt about 3 years ago. And Arendt is, of course, thrown out of her community entirely after the Eichmann book. So you have these women who write against the orthodoxy of a world in which they were revered and celebrated.
Yeah.
And they're dropped pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So is this what happens to Goldman a little bit?
Oh, absolutely.
And then she loses this...
Yeah, she loses, exactly. She loses,
Her income.
Support.
Her income also, right? Because she's no longer the popular speaker.
Yeah. Last part of her life was really mean, really mean. She as you say, her isolation was morbid and very, very, very strong. She didn't have money. She didn't have friends. She kept on doing, but it was all at a much lower level than before. The last part of her life, she was scrabbling for everything, for money, for support, for friends, for a venue. She hungered to come back to America, and she couldn't. She died in real exile in Canada, which meant nothing to her. That was a move she shouldn't have made, but there was no move for her to make. She was through with Europe, and it was a miserable, abject ending. Whenever she could, she remained herself. And as I describe her in, she gets involved, I think with these Italian anarchists, young people. She takes up whatever cause she can. She's always eager to, one moment of revival was the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah. She goes to London and raises money and organizes things.
Yeah, wherever she could. That was one great thing about her. No matter how low life brought her, give her half a chance to do something, to pull herself out of self-pity and isolation and inactivity. And she took it.
Right.
She took it. Right. That she should have a stroke and not be able to talk in the last months of her life was a bitter, bitter destiny.
For someone who spoke her whole life.
Oh, wouldn't shut up. She was taught. That's what she was. I mean.
I'm going to ask you a question toward the end, that because you wrote this introduction to this new edition, which we're really happy that we're presenting to 21st century readers.
Good,
And if Emma Goldman, what do you think she would... What does she mean today for where we are in, we're in the first fifth or whatever of the 21st century? And what has she meant to you as of when you started writing? Because you really had to immerse yourself. And what do you take from that? That someone who used her voice to make people feel their own experience.
What do I make?
Yeah.
Oh, I adore it. When I was young, it was Emma Goldman I wanted to be without really knowing much about her, I knew that she stood up on a platform and before 10,000 people urged revolution. I knew I had to get married and I needed the love of my life, but that was later. When I was 10 years old, I wanted to be Emma Goldman. And when I was 20, I wasn't so far from still wanting to be Emma Goldman.
And now, how do you know today?
She's a thrilling figure.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she is the kind of figure that makes humanity rich, really rich. It was exhausting living with her so long while I was writing this book. It was exhausting, but it was very absorbing.
What part was exhausting? That she's...
Oh, to be constantly in her presence through her writing and through having to read about her as well as read her. She is... she demands so much of her allies, her friends, the people that she affects.
Yeah.
She demands a lot of us. She demands active response from us.
But I think I love that you said she enriches humanity.
Yes.
So she gives and gives and gives, but she demands a lot.
Yeah.
And some people demand a lot, but they're not very giving. She's a very giving, larger, is a constant sense of like she's giving something to the world.
Most people are made in very moderate, us, we're made in very moderate amounts of all of it, of everything. Yeah. But she was made in the large, in the large.
Wow. Vivian, thank you so much. It's great. She came to life here for a moment. I love that. Yeah, I love that. So I want to thank you. And I also really want to thank you for writing the foreword to this
You're welcome.
We tried, Natasha Roy and I, we tried to edit what we thought was the most, maybe not really relevant because it turns it into this utilitarian, but the essays that speak to today's moment.
Yes.
So we tried to gather those in the book because they're available in many other longer editions.
Right, but you have.
We also want to just get people, Emma Goldman, Revolution as a Way of Life. Uh-huh. People should read that clearly, and then hopefully the essential Emma Goldman with Vivian's introduction.
Sure.
There are many other episodes of our podcast. Think about it.
You're having a good time.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. Wonderful. And an honor. Thank you.
That's great.